All right. So Skulk, introducing Skulk, we had this very provocative flyer that we sent out, the next great track, White Identity Redefined. And that is what Skulk is gonna try and address. And I'm very, very glad that I'm handing the microphone over to him. But let me just quickly say, Skulk is gonna introduce himself a little bit more. He's that vain. He doesn't think that I'm gonna do a good enough job, so he just thought that he'll introduce himself. It's not really because he's vain, but because his story, his testimony, is one of the big reasons why I think he can talk about this specific topic. What I can tell you about Skulk is he studied theology at the Destijdse Randse Afrikaanse Universiteit. And after that, he did development studies. He did his master's in development studies. And he asked me to please tell you that he did it cum laude. His master's, he really asked me to emphasize that in the church. So that's important. And from the rest, he's got an incredible organization that he heads up called Youth Zones and Zebra Crossing organizations. And please make sure that you understand or that you at least pay a visit to the website of Youth Zones and Zebra Crossings. It's quite inspiring. So without further ado, please welcome Magnus Cum Laude in Development Studies, Skulk van Heerden.
Good evening, everybody. Can everyone hear me okay? Moederskamer, vaderskamer. Great, I'm bringing good news tonight, and the good news I'm bringing is that I won't be preaching. So you can sigh a deep sigh of relief. You won't get a sermon tonight. You're going to hear my story, and the nice thing about my story is you're going to be inspired either about what to learn and what to do, or you're going to be inspired about what not to do and how not to think. So either way, you'll take something from my story, and I'll really try and just share my journey and some of the reflections and some of the perceptions I have as a result of my story. Karl Barth, the great theologian, said, you must sleep with a Bible and a newspaper next to your bed. And then he said it a few times, and he said, make sure you interpret the newspaper with your Bible and not vice versa. Why I'm thinking about that quote is when we talk about Afrikaner, like basically tonight I'm talking about what it is for me to be Afrikaner Christian. And why that mix? So for me, that's like newspaper and Bible. Sometimes we become so heavenly minded that we know earthly good. I think you've heard that one before. And I think true Christianity is what Bart said, is bring it from heaven, plunge into a full humanity. One of the things I'm fasting on is talking about my faith, and it's been about 10 years. So today I'm breaking a fast that I'm very ambiguous about. I think maybe I'm sinning as I'm standing here because I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do. But I'll share my story, and I think throughout the night, normally I've fasted, so I just talk about me as an Afrikaner and my social responsibility, things that make sense in my head, logically. And tonight I'm allowing myself, for the first time in many years, to talk openly about my faith, something I've felt that I shouldn't do for quite a while. So that might sound interesting, but Skulk, the Christian Afrikaner. In our country for a long time as Afrikaners, we were Afrikaners first and then Christians. Or Afrikaners first and then churchgoers. And we didn't want to bring politics into church, that's how I grew up. And that's also how we managed to do apartheid and get ourselves into a big mess, which you now hear guys with red berets talking about. So I like the idea of Bart bringing the Bible and the newspaper together. My identity as a follower of Christ and my identity as Afrikaner. Sometimes when we become born again, we say, no, I'm dying as Afrikaner, now I'm just a Christian. And that makes sense. Personally, I still try and bring the two together and on my journey. But tonight I'm saying that I'm a Christian first, and then I have to figure out what type of Afrikaner I can be as a Christian. So you answered I'm not allowed to talk if I don't have a scriffy, a Farsi. So I've found a Bible somewhere. And everything I'm going to tell you about my story tonight, I can interpret in the light of one particular verse or concept. It's a few times in the New Testament, but I'll pick one. And looking back, my whole life has been an interpretation of this scripture. We read a verse and we understand it, but as we live it, we understand deeper things about that verse, which is impossible to understand deeper unless you're doing it. So I'm standing here at the end of a long story about interpreting this verse, and I'll quickly read it. John 12. Unless a grain of wheat is buried in the ground, dead to the world, it is never any more than a grain of wheat. But if it is buried, it sprouts and reproduces itself many times over. In the same way, anyone who holds on to his life, holds on to life just as it destroys that life. But if you let it go reckless in your love, you'll have it forever, real and eternal. So it's the old story about if you try and hold your life, you lose it. But if you lose it, you'll gain it. And that is the theme I'll be chatting about quite often. So to introduce myself, I'm going to give you a very fast overview of some of the choices I've made in my life that included this little seed having to die, and then, surprise, surprise, it becomes alive again. Sometimes the same thing you get back, sometimes you don't get anything back, and something else opens up. But the first time back in 1993, when I got to know God, I was on an outreach to Hillbrow. So I grew up in Natal, and we went on an outreach, but I wasn't a Christian yet. That's how good boy I was, going to an outreach on holiday without being a Christian. So I was on the Hillbrow outreach there in the inner city, very scary. And Lady Elise said to me, "Listen, do you know about God or do you know God?" And just that, I've been overchurched up to that state. But just that question of hers changed my life forever. And she just said, "Do you actually know Jesus?" And I realized I knew everything about Jesus, but I didn't. And that was when I was born again. But even from that start, I sacrificed something. I sacrificed my holiday to go on an outreach, and I became born again. And that started a journey of a cycle of death and life. At that stage, I wanted to become a lawyer, and I felt called not to do that and to serve God in other ways, and I went to study theology. But sacrificing that picture of myself being a lawyer was one of the first big things I did. And then I grew up in the Dutch Reformed Church, the NG Kerk. And then after matric, I felt I had to do a year of my life or like a youth service. And I wanted to do the typical Dinsjaar CSV, moet om kassie hulle. And then I felt something in me that said I must go to a thing called Go School, and it was housed under the AFM church. And now those days, if you went from NG to AFM, it's almost like abandoning God, you know. So very difficult for me to leave the countryside, come to Joburg to an AFM-based youth for a youth year. So I took the plunge and I started really at zero because I didn't know anything about the AFM church and all of that. And I did that for a year. And then the second year, it went well there and I learned a lot and I wanted to do a second year. And then I had a choice. I could go to the United States and be a youth pastor in a church. And all I knew about it is Mel Gibson's daughter was there. So as a young 19-year-old, I was very excited about that. And then they said, but they also need a couple of guys to go and start a missions farm in Mozambique. And it's obvious which one I wanted to do. By that time, I've never went overseas, so the States thing sounded very spectacular. But I made a choice which I felt in prayer was going to be good for my character, and I went to live in the middle of Mozambique in a tent for a year and ended up killing 30 puff adders. And it was an interesting journey that really changed me, and my dad loved it because he think finally he's becoming a man, you know. So I went to Mozambique, and certain things was planted in my head. When I came back from Mozambique and started studying now at university, I was very conservative Christian kid. So going to university, I didn't want to go into the residence because you know how it goes at residence at a university, especially in the old days. And again, I felt called to go into the university, into the residence of Slon, and live there among the heathen, you know. And by that time, I was already 21, and I still rolled in as a first year, so I was going to go through the whole initiation and ontgroening. And I took that plunge, and it was very interesting and good for me. And as I studied, in my second year, I was on the house committee, and I was basically elected to be the, in Afrikaans, it's onder primarius, so it's like the deputy head boy of the kursus, which was for me a big thing, because as a young kid coming in, I wasn't sure, am I going to make it? And here I was on the verge of running the kursus in my second year, which was very unknown or unheard of at that stage. I was excited about that leadership opportunity. And then, again, I felt a strong calling to say, no, it's enough now of residence life, because I'm starting to enjoy it too much, and I've passed the test. And I felt I have to start now going to work at a church while I'm studying. Again, took the plunge, worked at church, and I discovered everyone thought, if you're a pastor or a domine, you're a special Christian because you study these things. So then in revolt against that, I stopped my studies, which was very, very tough for me as a little achiever, because then I was a university dropout because I didn't finish my studies. It was very embarrassing, but I felt that's what I needed to do, to say, no, you can be a full follower of Christ without a degree in theology. You don't have to be a special Christian to preach. So I was working at the church, and I was the only one refusing to have a theology qualification. But I did that out of a deep conviction about my theology, ironically. So I sacrificed my studies, and they accepted it. I don't know why, but they accepted me doing that. And then after a couple of years, I felt called to go permanently and live in Mozambique. And that is where a calling change came. What I sensed is, at that stage, I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I became a professional Christian, and I spoke for a living. And then I felt really called to serve. That's my phrase. And called to serve means doing stuff out of love for other people on their own terms, not on my terms. So being nice to someone without at the end doing the sinner's prayer or showing the Jesus film or having the Christian angle. So I felt very strongly called to go to Mozambique and to do stuff to show God's love. And the motivation was 100% missionary, but I felt I must sacrifice my idea of being a missionary. That makes sense. Am I using the right words? So I resigned from my church, which was my dream job. All the young seminary students wanted that job. And I quit that, and I went to Mozambique and lived in a tent next to a river. And there I had to sacrifice and learn many things. I was the only whitey there, which is how you would probably feel now, Tolani, very scary. I had to learn to speak Portuguese, so when I arrived, I couldn't understand anyone. And I just lived there, and my principle was, I'm not starting a project until I learn certain things from the locals. So I was the only white kid learning Portuguese in the middle of the bush, and after staying in the tent, the guy in the local butchery gave me a room, and I accepted that. And at the end, I discovered it's a little room at the top of the butchery, and the butchery didn't have refrigerators. So that's where I stayed for a couple of years, in an African butchery. But it was crazy times. I won't go into all the details now of my Mozambique years. But I had to sacrifice a lot, besides a few times dying from malaria almost. I kept at it, sometimes out of my Afrikaner stubbornness, but mostly out of what I felt God is calling me to do there. And then I thought I should start studying again and finish what I started, because I'm there in the middle of nowhere, so no one would know anyway about it. So I studied again. It was difficult studying from Mozambique at Rau, which wasn't a distance education. So that was a whole different journey. And I finished my degree, and I started studying development studies, and in the class I was the only male, only Christian, only non-vegetarian. So it was a very liberal bunch that did development studies, and they shaked everything I thought I knew. When I spoke about my faith, they said, "Don't you think you're arrogant that you think you're right and that we're going to hell?" I'm like, "No, I'm not arrogant. I love you. I must help you not to end there, you know." And they just cut to bits so many of my ideas. So that shift from theology to development studies really plunged me into so much uncertainty. And then I started to gradually bind together my development studies and my Christianity and learn from both sides. After 6 years in Mozambique, I felt it's time to come back. Some people say I came back to find a wife. Others say I came back to earn money, because for 6 years in Mozambique, I lived off 2,000 rand a month, which included petrol for the car or whatever. So when I'm talking about a calling to sacrifice, you can imagine I grew up in a good house and then living in a tent of 1.5 a month. It's a way different lifestyle than what we might think. So I came back and I went to work at the University of Johannesburg, heading up the community engagement division. And I was called the acting head of community engagement. And then I had the privilege of being one of the early victims of BEE. So my colleague Monkey, that I was kind of helping and training, became the acting head of community engagement. So she became my boss. And I had to quickly make a decision there about how am I going to view all of this. So I had my challenges in Mozambique, but now I'm back in South Africa and this is my reality. And I quickly made a link to think, my journey with BEE is part of my journey of what Jesus is calling me to do. So I love the fact that I had a chance for that little seed there to die and to be planted for something else to come up. So that's how I started viewing that. And then one morning, I was talking on radio about my journeys in Mozambique, and Rolf Meyer, the ex-politician, heard me speaking, and he phoned me up and said, please quit your job and come and start a project for us, working in townships. And we had a chat, and I had a few prayers, and chatted to friends, and after 2 days, I quit at the university where I had a full-time position as in community engagement division. And I quit that, which was very difficult, because if you're in this field of community work, as a white male, there's not many job opportunities around. So I was really in the dream job at the university, full-time, getting government money. And I stepped out of there to start a new thing where I had no job security. We didn't even know if it was going to work. And I took that plunge, and that's where Youth Zones was born, my current job, 6-7 years ago. And it went great, but that's a plunge I had to do. And along this journey, I had to sacrifice many things. I bought my first flat now when I was 38 years old. That's tough for Afrikaners, manhood, you know, if you don't have a place to stay. So there's a couple of things I had to sacrifice along the way. Relationships was very difficult through all these crazy times. And now I had to sacrifice my singleness again. And I've been 2 years with Marley sitting there. So that's also another adaptation you have to make. You get rewards, obviously, but there's certain things you have to let down. So very quickly, my whole life has been for me this journey of every new door to open implied I had to use a key of sacrifice to give up something first, and then something else opened up by God's grace. Sometimes that thing opening up was also tough, but it showed me things I couldn't imagine where I was previously stuck. And after 4 doors opening, when you get there, you would never have guessed that God will take you there. But you had to be faithful in the small decision He gave you right there. And that's the journey I went on. And now looking back, I can see patterns. And that's where my days in the bush and now in the townships, I've had very tough times with my identity as Afrikaner. And somehow God brought these two callings together, where I'm a South African Afrikaner. And I like to use the metaphor of the great trek. You saw the little ossewaar there, the ox wagon. Afrikaners, I think, that's my take on it. You might not agree. We're very courageous people, coming from Europe to Cape Town and from Cape Town to Transvaal, and some are still going north to Zambia and whatever. They're still pushing. But in a way, Afrikaners are pioneers, and I like to identify with that. But what I realize we do as Afrikaners, when we get scared, we pull a lager. Ons trek 'n kringetjie, and we've got our wagons locked in because we have a perceived enemy on the outside. And what my journey taught me is when we close up because we're uncertain or scared, we sometimes assume someone is the enemy, but they actually can be part of our inner circle. So what I realized in Mozambique and now in the township, My brothers in the township in Mozambique, although they're black and not Afrikaners, are part of my family. They're Bhutis, they're brothers and sisters. So now if I'm scared and I pull my lager, the lager doesn't look like me. It's not a homogenous group. There's a mix in there. And I think including different type of people in your lager is part of the gift as Afrikaner. Many people will say Afrikaners have got a lot of hospitality. Am I right? We're generous and hospitable people. I think that includes bringing different people into your circle. And where the metaphors came together is this groot trek that we had as Afrikaners. And for us now to have a groot trek into the township or into the real South Africa reminded me of the incarnation of Christ, where Jesus came all the way from heaven, came to earth and became a man, and started journeying with us, nobodies. Because we're not Jews, we're not really the God's chosen people as the Afrikaners, contrary to popular belief. So exactly what Jesus modeled to us, about coming to us, journeying with us, I think is our call to imitate Jesus. And South Africa is the perfect place to imitate Jesus. Because we can go against some of our fleshly instincts and decide, but I'm going into a new area where I might be surprised by what I find there. And it's not to say I'm going down, I'm going to somewhere different. So for me, the next great trek is from Sandton to Alex, or from Waterkloof to Mamelodi, and pick any spot you want, because we've been in our lager a little bit too much. And now if we see on TV attacks on our lager, we pull it tighter, and we get angry, and we feel threatened. And I think it's so ironic, because through my journey, which is long before the EFF got started, I realized that the enemy is not a real enemy. It's an unbelievable invitation to go to the other side. And that's not just to say going to black people or just going to the poor. But that calling of Jesus to go to the other side, I think is very pertinent for us. And that's why when I hear a verse like, if you have two coats, give one away. Have you ever heard about that verse? It's a horrible one, eh? Because if I ask now who's got two shirts or two coats, it's every single one of us, am I right? But somehow we're not doing that. When the rich guy asked Jesus, what must he do? He said, obey the commandments. And then he said, no, sell all your stuff and give it to the poor. That's even worse than what any political party in South Africa will tell you. Much more hardcore. So when black liberals start talking about white guilt and white privilege and white responsibility, we be like, hey, what do you want? Ne? And what I realized is Jesus is asking much more of me than any black liberal intellectual who's going to talk about white privilege. No? And even at church, we get told, give 10%, do tithing. I don't think that's 100% biblical. Everything I own belongs to Jesus and to God. The question is, what am I allowed to use on myself? The rest I should share with my brothers and sisters. So my calling from Jesus is unbelievably exciting and hardcore on this side. And then my church is kind of calling me to some stuff here. And then the guys that we normally get scared of, they don't even want that much. But yet, that's where we close up. And it's a weird one. So, I'm sensing the calling from Jesus towards sharing my luck. I like to use the word luck rather than privilege. So I'm lucky in the way I grew up. And I think being a nice person and a good Christian means I have to share that. It's a no-brainer for me. And I'm excited about that. At the same time, we as Afrikaners in this country messed up. We took things from people, and we don't like to say that. But we took things. I'm not talking if you don't have a farm, you're like, luckily I didn't take anything. We took opportunities from generations of people. We took dignity. And I can say now I didn't take anything because I'm just luckily too young. I never voted under apartheid. So I didn't take it. But I'm sharing in the good life of that which was taken. So on my political side, I want to be very open with you. We have to think, just from the human perspective, look at our country, look what happened, and re-evaluate where we are as Afrikaners. I'm saying tonight, that doesn't have to scare us. Because evaluating where I am as a Christian is way more radical. And as an invitation that's going to cost so much more. And here our role model, Jesus, he gave so much that he ended up dying. He lost his whole life and he died for us. And he says, we must do the same. Which is crazy. Né? It's very, very radical. So to what extent will we follow Jesus? We shouldn't die on a cross because that doesn't happen these days. So luckily we don't have to do that. We just have to give away our second coat. Né? So it's less of a than dying. Although so many Christians through the years had to follow Jesus until death. So let's forget that calling. Just take it a notch back and say, let's just share our stuff. Share what's in my mind. Share what's in my heart. Share what's in my wallet. And share my time. That's... when I hear that, I don't feel burdened or guilty or scared. What my life has taught me is every time I've sown something, every time I've buried something, something came up that was a massive gift and spectacular, which I got back. So as I'm standing in front of you, I feel tremendously privileged and rich. But without bragging, I must say I've given away and given up almost every imaginable thing I could give up. I've given up. But I didn't bore you with some of those details. But still, the calling for me excites me. And the phrase I'll use is, depending on what prize you're after with a Z, you can pay any price. Ne? Die Preis, any price in Afrikaans is the same word. But if the prize, which is Jesus Christ, is attractive enough, then the price to pay is nothing. So if I see someone getting all defensive about having to not buy the Maserati, but rather buy the Fortuner, if you're having a soul struggle about whether your car should be $500,000 or $1.2 million, if you don't want to let that go, then I'm not going to talk to you about cars. I'm going to ask you about the prize that's in your mind that you feel called to. So for me, Jesus is so attractive and exciting and so much prize that whatever price he asks me to pay, I'll pay. And that's an invitation. Great. EFF loves that too, because they also want me to give up some things. So I'm like, great, come, Sam. But where we must be very sure about our true calling and why we're doing things is when an intellectual black liberal, sorry for that label, attacks me and says, Skulk, you are so arrogant and patronizing. You guys caused all the problems. Now you're so arrogant to think you can still come and solve them. Please, we've had enough of you. Just do nothing. Then I can feel easily feel offended. So I must be very sure, everything I do in my life, my time, my budget, am I doing that in search of Jesus and how Jesus says, if you give a glass of water to someone, you're giving it to me? So what is my true motivation? And if I can feel depressed because I'm watching the news or reading some comments on Facebook, then I must ask myself, why am I living this incarnational lifestyle? Is it to please the people in the country or my guilt? Or is it to follow my Savior? And that's where I'm loving it in South Africa. And you said, I won't immigrate. This is the best place for me to follow Christ. Because the demands of our country and our God fits like a hand in a glove. And that's why all these chats that we normally get depressed about, I get excited about. So there's a few other verses and stuff I wanted to share with you. But I think in terms of theology, we might be on the same page. Maybe one for the Q&A is, Jesus said there'll always be the poor with you, ne? Maybe we could get to that one if anyone is curious about that question, because as Afrikaners, we can easily get discouraged, or we give up. We're like, what difference can I make? Even if I do this, that will happen. And I think as a follower of Christ, we must be humble enough. And that was my first things to learn in Mozambique. I was one little kid in a country of 17 million. First thing I had to realize is I can't save the world. But that's not what it's about. It's about what's my next step. Not can I change everything. So the poor will always be with us as an invitation. And if you struggle to talk to Jesus, which I think if we're honest, it's difficult to have a relationship with the invisible God. If you're telling me it's not difficult, you're lying. It's difficult. Yes, skulk das Johan, is Tulani, where's Jesus? No? It's difficult, I'm telling you. It's difficult. And when God feels far away or the ceiling feels solid, I know where Jesus is hiding. He's hiding among the poor. If you read your whole New Testament, it's very obvious where Jesus is hanging out. I'm not saying he's not with the rich. Please understand very well. But God has always been picking the poor as his favorite spot. And what I can share from my life is if you're struggling to see Jesus and you immerse yourself into poverty or poor areas, you're going to find Jesus in new ways that you never expected. And that's an incredible invitation. How to see more of Jesus? Visit the poor. He's hidden among the poor, literally. So that's why I'm talking about an invitation and not a depressing topic. When we get engaged like this and bring Jesus to the world, bring Jesus into our own lives, giving ourselves up, the hardest thing to give up, okay, you might think it's money, but it's not money. The hardest thing to give up is our own minds, our own ideas, that sense of being right, of understanding everything. Through my journey, I had to change my mind so many times, admitting there I'm wrong, there I'm naive, and probably half of what I'm saying tonight, I'll also still discover it was wrong. And then I'll have to humbly again say sorry and see what's the fuller revelation of that. So when we immerse ourselves in the townships or just make friends that's different from you, you can use that as a tool to see where your current thinking is not perfect, because it's impossible for any of us to have a perfect understanding of all topics. I know we might think my brother-in-law is that one who knows everything, but besides him, it's very difficult to have a full understanding. And I think when you engage with people that's radically different from you, let's say they're not Christian, let's say they're living in a shack, different gender than you, different beliefs, they're going to challenge you to think in different ways. And I think that is a blessing from God, because it shakes us up and it will make our faith either crumble or it will make our faith stronger. And I think the last thing I want to say is, in South Africa today, the Christian life is a paradox. You have to die to live. Ne? That's a paradox. And as an Afrikaner today, we're living in a paradox. Everything is uncertain. And that's why we feel so weird sometimes, because everything's uncertain. But we can embrace that uncertainty. But we have to just stand there and say, my one lecturer at university, he said, the best answer a theologian can ever give is to say, I don't know. That's the most theological thing you can say as a human being. But if I listen to conversations today, I don't hear people saying, I don't know. I don't know how to do that. Everyone wants to fight their own angle. Yet Jesus says, give up your life. Lay it down. But we get so defensive and selfish, not just on material things, but especially on our mind space. We don't want to change the way we're thinking. And I like to ask people, when was the last time you changed your mind where you said, on this thing, I was 100% wrong. But now I've seen the light. And normally we can't even think of something. When was the last time you were 100% wrong about something? So I think our journey with Jesus calls us to a humility that embraces that uncertainty, that grayness, that in-between, that paradox. And that's how I feel in South Africa at the moment. So Johan gave me a list of very naughty questions, of which the one was, do we belong here as white people? After many years and sleepless nights, my answer to that would be no. We don't belong here. Now you're thinking, why is Skalk saying that? Meh? Do we belong here? I'm saying no, we don't belong here as white people. Why do I say that? Well, firstly, because I've had enough drunk black friends that told me when they're drunk, they get the courage to speak freely. And they say, it would have been better if that boat never came here. And it's logistically complicated, but if you could all go back, it would again be great. That people tell me after 5 or 6 years of friendship, not first night. We don't belong here, and when people drink enough, they'll tell you we don't belong here. That's true, and I believe that. But then again, I want to bring this paradox in. As a Christian, do we belong on earth? Is this our world? We're not. This is not our place. We're on a journey with a spectacular end destination. So again, my theology and my reality as Afrikaner fits perfectly. I don't belong here. I cannot feel at home. I must hold lightly to everything that I find to be precious, because anything can be taken from me. Not just as Afrikaner in South Africa, but as a Christian on planet Earth. So do we belong here? Probably not. But we can be spectacular visitors. You've all been on holiday where you had a great time, and you behaved well, hopefully, on that holiday, and you made some connections. That's what we can do here. So stop fighting about do we belong here or not. No, we don't. But let's be great visitors and enjoy our holiday. 80 years, let's enjoy it. And we behave like good visitors that respect the local people we're visiting. Anyway, that's one of my answers. Let me read some of these ones. How much should white people give? No-brainer. Everything. Nah? If you're a Christian, the answer is simple. Nothing I have belongs to me. So I should be willing to give everything. But because we're human beings and imperfect, for today, give as much as you can. As your journey with God continues, you'll be able to give more. First, people have to shoot for 10%. Great. Some never reach it. They die before that. But if you look at the Old Testament, all these little taxes and givings and offerings, really biblical standard is 30%. Not of netto, of brutto. So 30% should be your biblical standard of what you give. If you don't, I'm not stressed. You have a next step for yourself. So if you're on 0%, 1%. If you're on 1%, 5%, until you start tithing. When you're doing your tithing, great, that other 90% also belongs to Jesus. And get up to 30%. And half of my circle of friends give away half their money. And they're Afrikaners and they're Christians. But that's their journey, but they didn't start there. So how much should we give? Everything. For now, as much as you can, and I think we should be fair. Give grace to everyone. You don't do what you feel right for now. And then your journey will continue. Like I said, you can't open that door now. You must first open this one. The next question is, what mistakes do white people make? Oof, millions. The biggest mistake white people make when we visit townships is we think we're the teacher. We think we've got the stuff and we must give it. So at my work, I do a very simple task. If you say you want to visit a township with me, I ask you, what do you expect to gain from the township? People literally don't have anything to say. I'm like, no, think about it. If you're there interacting, what are you going to learn? What can you get that you can't get at the moment? And we literally don't have an answer to that question. Some will come with a classic, which makes my black friends angry. I can learn to gumbo dance, or I can learn to speak Zulu, or we have a few patronizing examples. But what can you learn if you made friendships with kids living in shacks? If you don't have good answers to that, please don't go to the township because you're going to destroy everything. So that's our biggest mistake. We go thinking we have to give. When I went to Mozambique, I went thinking I can give. I got infinitely more than I could ever give. I didn't even have anything to give. Maybe that was the blessing. I was a poor white man, so they could give. Give me accommodation, give me food, teach me to speak Portuguese, teach me to play football, teach me to use the computer. So I learned everything from the Mozambicans, and that changed our dynamic. I would say that is at the root of everything we do wrong. So we think we're on top and we must give down. What can whites say without being racist? Nothing. Listen to me, we can say nothing without being racist. Because racism is a big story over many years which left some people feeling powerless and others feeling powerful. And that's something deep in your ingrained. And what can we say without being racist? I'm saying nothing, because our time for saying is finished. It's now our time to start listening. That's what you can do. So if you're a white Afrikaner and you go to the township, sit on your bum and listen. The moment you start saying something, why I'm saying that will be racist is the moment you start sharing, you're the one on stage, you're the one talking, you're the one setting the agenda. Even if you're explaining to them about Jesus or explaining to them about education or how important it is for you to read to your children, you being the initiator. And that is perpetuating the power dynamic of the white Afrikaner in charge and the black person receiving or being a beneficiary. So what can we say without being racist? Nothing, and that's great. Let's stop talking and listen. That's not big. If we have to sacrifice our lives like Jesus, let's sacrifice our tongue. I don't know if I'm making sense to anyone. I'm seeing everyone is checking like the frowning part. So maybe I'm sounding harsh to say you can say nothing, but I think you get the point I'm making behind that. That self-discipline and humility to sit and be quiet and really to learn, so that when you go away from the township and someone asks you, what did you learn? You can carry on for an hour. Normally when I take people to the township and we leave, I say, what did you learn? They say, yo, I learned I have to appreciate. Yo, my holidays, my Prado, my this, I have to appreciate. That's what I learned today. And that's the takeaway. If that's your takeaway from the township, that you have to appreciate all your goodies, then you didn't see anything. And then you spoke too much. And even listening can be a type of talking where you look and you label. As you see everything, you're putting little labels on it. I would have made my toilet like that. Oh, this street, I would have done that. So you're looking and listening, but in your mind, you don't have a listening posture of really wanting to understand deeper. So what can we say? The question shouldn't be even, what can I say? It's fine to be quiet. Say, I don't know. Maybe if you want to say anything, it's I'm sorry. We joke about it, saying, ach, ek het nou genoeg jammer gesê. I have enough now of saying sorry. No, we can say sorry. What does it do to you to say sorry? Does it harm you in any way? So I don't understand Afrikaner. I don't want to say sorry. What is difficult about saying sorry? I'm literally not understanding it. We have such a big... I'm going to speak very honest now. White people always say black people are entitled. Am I lying if I say that? There's entitlement. They should work. We are entitled. They think, oh, let's just forget about the past and move on. I want to do this and that. That's our own entitlement. Sacrifice your entitlement and say sorry again. It doesn't take anything away from you. So what can I say without being racist? Nothing, or maybe sorry. And why I'm saying maybe sorry, ne? If you're smart, and now after hearing this, you go to a township and you say, I'm sorry, then you know you're taking away the guilt, they must forgive you. So there's a whole positive thing of that. So sometimes you shouldn't even say sorry. So you're sitting in that tension of anger and resentment. So sometimes you must even sacrifice your sorry so that you get the full force. And then there'll come a time where you can say you're sorry and start relieving the pressure. Nog 'n vraagie, another question. What does sustainable Christian social upliftment look like? That's quite a mouthful. I'm sure you also read cum laude at your studies. Sustainable Christian social upliftment. The only thing I want to say there is social upliftment, how to fight poverty, is a science like anything. You can go and study it. You can learn best practice, which it's not my job tonight to go into that. But when you put an airbag in your car, you don't say, how do I put a Christian airbag in my car? Or when I build my house, how to use Christian bricks? No? There's good principles of building and making airbags. And we use that in our cars. So when we go to the township, the idea of saying I'm on a Christian outreach is something you must sacrifice just to be normal again. And you, Tulani, come on. Are you crying? Are you okay? No, so, and earlier I said we don't want to change our mind and then black people stay angry at us. So, sacrifice your idea of Christian outreach and just ask someone, what do you need in your life to do better, to feel better, to take a next step? And then you'll hear what is a good social upliftment practice. But it's not part of our agenda that we're pushing. So, yeah, so I would deconstruct sustainable Christian social upliftment. I don't think it exists. But sustainable social upliftment is something where you can get very smart. I did everything wrong when I started on my journey. And I had to painfully learn every lesson. I had to learn how a soup kitchen 90% of the time is more damaging than good. Yeah, because it perpetuates certain power relationships. So there's a whole stack of things which I can follow up with people. Good reading, maybe put a couple of books in here. But it's a science and there's good practice, like in any discipline. So how to do it well is great, because we do it in stupid ways. And when it doesn't work, we blame the poor again. But we did it the wrong way. Next question that was asked. How can the church help our brothers and sisters in townships? Again, I've got a simple answer. Be brothers and sisters. Think of your real brother and sister, how you interact with them, and interact in the same way with someone in the township. So, I've never heard of churches going on township outreach, but taking it like brother and sister. So, for example, when you go on your next holiday, you go with your family normally. So take the person from the township with you on holiday. Everything doesn't have to be a life skills course or a boiler making certificate or whatever. Just take someone with you on holiday. Bring someone into your house. Sleep over. I had a hardcore Zulu doing a seminar in Joburg, and he stayed in my flat. After this great seminar, he went back to Natal, Numlazi, and he put on Facebook the highlight of his week in Joburg was using Skalk's towel. So for that big black man, just using my towel felt like, am I allowed to use a white guy's towel? That changed his life. And I never thought that is my outreach or that's my development. So just treating someone like a brother and sister is really what our country needs. And again, that's something fun. It's great. It's not a heavy burden. What does the poor see when they see a white man walking in the township? I have that one every day because I'm always alone where I work. People see different things. Some people are curious. Some people are skeptical because they think there's already someone who has an agenda, so they're going to act like they want to help me, but really they want something. Like I must become a Christian or I must sign up for this. So some people are skeptical. Some are curious. Some people are genuinely good-hearted and that will just welcome you in. Some people are resentful because they've been having issues with whites all the time, but they never see a white. So now there's one. So all that baggage comes in, and I'm normally the beneficiary of that. So then you have to take one on your chin. And the last one, Johan, that I'll quickly say, how can I make a difference in a township or a difference in our country? And there I've got a long, long list, but maybe I can condense them in two themes. The one, how can I make a difference in our country, is to be engaged long term. And with that, I don't mean 3 weeks in a row or two Mandela days. 10 years. Stick to it. If you're going to say, Tulani is going to be my first black friend, write in your prayer journal, I'm giving it 10 years. So that when you anger each other, you go through that tough time. In the township, you'll be disappointed weekly. And then there has to be something that binds you. So make a commitment in the long run, like the difference between dating and marriage. Make a commitment for the long run, and then those ups and downs, you'll go through that because of your long-term commitment. And then what can we do for our country? The biggest thing that I'll say to end everything with, don't change anyone in the township. Become honest and real with Jesus, what Jesus lived, what Jesus modeled. What is Jesus calling us to do? Simple things that's like that in the Bible. What is my calling to Jesus, towards Jesus? And for me, if I'm not ready to take the jump, at least to give one step in the direction of Jesus' calling. And if every Afrikaans person in this country took real steps towards Jesus and the lifestyle Jesus asked us to live, this country would really become a miracle again. Because the road of Jesus is one of humility and learning and dying for ourselves, not protecting what we have. So how can we make our country great? Make Skulk great or better or less harmful. And then it will automatically happen. So it's not a technical solution. It's a fundamental state of being that must get serious about Jesus. And then the rest you'll figure out easy. Well, not easy, but it will get figured out. Yeah, so that's the answer to that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Skulk. I know you've got this massive fast that you are working on, so I'm not going to burden you with a prayer, but would you maybe just quickly pray for us before we open up for Q&A?
I'll pray for myself. It's going to be a Q&A. Father, we can never come to you lightly. And every time I close my eyes or try and talk to you, I start with repentance. And I thank you for your grace that through what you did on earth, you make us free, even if we stuff up so many times. Thank you that you are the prize that is worth any price. And please forgive me for all the things tonight that I've said that I won't do in the coming months or that I haven't been doing. And I want to ask you tonight to help me and all of us to lay down some of our ideas, some of that desire to be right. And I pray that as we continue this chat that you will give us the grace to understand each other and for me and everyone else to see where we can think in a more Christ-like manner. Thank you that we're not left alone in this crazy world. Thank you that we have a best friend that showed us how to do it. Amen.
All right. Guys, please don't let Skull get away with what he said. So, yes, we need to sacrifice, but you don't have to sacrifice your question. If something annoyed you, then this is dialogue, not monologue. So, so please feel free to ask those questions that you think he needs to respond to.
So I brought two papers. The one is what I said, and the other one is what I'm supposed to learn here tonight. And if they're not equal, then I've already messed up. So please, let's talk and have Q&A so that we can learn now from the floor. Né?
Thanks, Skulk, even Achtera. Thank you very much. Just to clarify something specifically, you said what can we do? Nothing. What can we say? Nothing. What can we do? We must just kind of had the idea, don't do anything too much. Just make a long-term commitment. And that's often something that I do find an issue with personally, is to say, I'm happy to say sorry, but I really want to do something now. And it often feels that those attempt to do something now, the what can we say without being racist? And you say nothing. So it just feels as if for us that often view ourselves as pioneers, that really let's do something now. That we stuck and saying, no, we can't do something. And I heard long term, but that's the only thing. Is there something more? Because we want to do something more.
It's a good question. I think maybe I didn't say some things because I think it's logical, like breathing the air. For saying, I think we don't need to say something, but even to not say something in a great way means you have to get in your car, drive to the nearest township, make a friend, and then sit and say nothing. So it's not saying anything on your couch watching box office. Yeah? So even not saying something can be a very powerful thing that takes your time and money to be seated in the right places to say nothing. So when I came and I heard about this group, I was very excited because a bunch of Afrikaners speaking English for the idea of being inclusive. Now it's amazing. And I want to congratulate you. That is massive. So not speaking Afrikaans in our country is one of the best things you can do. Ne? So it's very powerful that not doing something like not speaking Afrikaans, but it implies speaking English and saying R and is and when it's in the wrong time. So even the not saying can include a lot of doing. Your question about what to do, when I say long-term involvement, I just mean don't do something now and then stop and do something then and stop. I am 100% convinced in doing something every single moment of the day. So I'm definitely not saying don't do anything. Do something and never stop doing and commit. And that's the only place where you learn is by making those mistakes. I think the main point I'm making tonight, because we're a Christian community, is you don't start by going to do outreach. You start by becoming more Christ-like. And that's also not, I'm not doing anything. To follow Jesus is to do a lot, as the ways in which you sacrifice your life. That could imply sacrificing your language at university. It's a real question for Afrikaners following Jesus. So that first step towards Jesus means reading different things, hanging out in different places. So that's just my first step is towards Jesus. A little bit like the Christian thing about grace and works. It's not this or that. It's always first grace. Always first your relationship with Jesus. And then that overflows into good works. And if there's no good works, the Bible tells us you have to seriously ask your fundamental question. So I just want to clarify, my talk tonight was about us getting real with Jesus as a first step. And then, I mean, I'm the guy that went to Mozambique and spends every day in a different township. So it's all about doing, but after the fundamentals with Jesus. And how to do it, I think don't start something new. Join an existing group that's got momentum, that's got track record, and join someone else's initiative that you can learn in a safe space. Without good deeds, there's your religion is fake. I think the Bible is clear on that. Does that answer?
All right, Scott, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Well, I appreciate the angle you're using. That was the kind of Christian angle. Oh, sorry. As I think, and just I suppose this is a comment you could clarify into, like, I mean, Jesus was, in my mind, completely communist. He was a hardcore communist. And the disciples, the apostles after him, were hardcore communists. So one thing is, are you actually saying, and is this actually a problem for capitalism versus socialism rather than communism? Because isn't that really the problem? Is I can give money to poor people. That's not fixing it. Our system is inherently flawed. And isn't that really the problem? So I understand your angle, why you didn't come in on that. You came in on the Christian angle. But isn't our problem a capitalistic versus a socialistic problem?
Okay, horrible question. To answer that question, I'm reading a thick book like this, The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, written 200 years ago, but he's the father of capitalism, because I had to delve to the bottom line of that problem. And I'm not going to now hijack this into an academic discussion, but what I'll quickly say, my perspective, not the right answer, but my understanding of it, is what I'm learning from Adam Smith in the fundamentals of capitalism, that capitalism in its pure form can only work when there's a humanity and a charity built into that. So that if I've got the ability to perform and to make something, I use that, I get reward for that, and then I reach out and I help those that didn't have the ability to milk the system and harvest the fruits in that sense. So from the beginning of, I think, pure capitalism, one can read it again if you have time, but I think capitalism can only work if it has a very heavy chunk of charity built into that, because capitalism assumes some are stronger than others. And if the strongest ones just push, 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 these ones will get poorer and poorer and they will revolt, and like the French Revolution, etc., etc., they'll throw it over. So for your own sake in selfish capitalism, that charitable or giving side is fundamental to keep the system alive. So that's your big key where I think capitalism, Jesus, I don't think was a communist. I think more probably socialist is what we can call it, about sharing your stuff. I think we should stay away from meta debates, although that's part of what I do every day, is we can argue these things at length. But for me as an academic and a Christian, I think I should rather just ask myself, what is my next step? And in the early church, when they gave baskets of food to the hungry, the practice was that basket would be passed around 5 times before someone actually ate that food. Because every time you give it to this person in a shack, and then that Christian said, you know what, I can actually still survive today. Give it to someone that's poorer than me. And they took that basket and they gave to the next one and the next one, and then it only got eaten eventually. So I think there's a big chunk of what we might call a socialism in what Jesus tells us, but I think we mustn't call that socialism. We must just call it sharing our stuff. It's as simple as that. When I'm with my 2 sisters watching rugby and I've got the biltong, if I don't do this, then I'm being a stupid. Nay, I'm not being a socialist. I'm just sharing my biltong. So, and that's how I think we should look at it. And it's maybe capitalism that allowed me to buy the biltong. But great, now we have biltong and we share it. If I didn't buy the biltong, there was no biltong. Then they still wouldn't have biltong. So, I think, yes. The national movement won't be socialism, because that also doesn't work. So that's the big paradox or the uncertainty, that sentence about I don't know. We know socialism doesn't work. It's been proven over and over. Capitalism also doesn't work. So we've got 2 systems that doesn't work. So there's not a system we can fight for that will work. My personal gut is that capitalism, with a very big chunk of a welfare state that uses the talents of some to uplift the others, and that keeps the whole thing going, could be great if it's done in the right way. That's what I think. If the charity part is big enough, and charity is nothing else than giving 40% of your money to the tax man, that money gets given to the poor, hospitals, road, blah, blah, blah. So I think the system is not as unmanageable, and we're not going to change it to anything else. But that's a great chat. I don't think there's another system that we can fight for. But I think we can give capitalism a human face, where again, if you earn something, you're not entitled to that. You've earned something based in a system that allowed you to excel, and then you're a nice guy and you share that with those that didn't have the opportunity or the know-how to become as rich. I think where it becomes crazy is if we link capitalism with consumerism. That becomes then, that selfish consumerism, I think, is the real disease that you can make groups around. Maybe bomb advertising houses. So it's a long one. I'm not going to give you an answer. But yeah, so I think we must be paralyzed in the meta-narrative. But for you as a Christian, there's an obvious, what am I doing with my biltong? And that can be more empowering than what we think, because most big revolutions start with grassroots examples. So it's not going to satisfy you, I know. But thanks for asking and complicating things. Yes?
Something, I'm with you with most of what you said. Something I'm wondering about, though, is it just that that white people should give? Or is it that everyone who has the means should give? And obviously, white people are a soft target there and a legitimate target. Increasingly, though, it's not just a white thing. So isn't it just that, you know, it's not a race thing, it's a human thing. And as humans and as Christians, we have that responsibility.
Thank you for asking that. I want to be naughty and give you an opportunity, which I had to have as well the last year. And a black friend of mine helped me with this. Why do you ask that question? Why do you have the desire to clarify things for the others? Why do you want to hear? No, I'm not wanting to hear your answer right now. Why, if they say we as whites must give, then, or let's take privilege, out of my own mouth came the sentence, yeah, yeah, I get white privilege, but what about black privilege? Ne? Poor Marlee dates me, she has all my issues. I'm like, if you're an old white guy like my dad driving an Etios, and a black guy parks next to you with a Jaguar, what is my dad's white privilege responsibility, and what's that guy's responsibility? Because the chat in our country at the moment is kind of always, white people must give, but what about black privilege? Actually, Tulani used the phrase in my first meeting that I ever met him, and I was so happy he said that, because, yeah, that just feels right, you know, white privilege and black privilege. But when we do that, what you just did, I do it naturally. When we do that, our black friends get very angry at us, because they're like, what's your problem? Do you do your white thing and we'll do our black thing, ne? You get what I'm saying? So I'm just saying that your question is a question being asked a lot out there, and it's making black people angry. So now in public spaces, it's one of the things I try and sacrifice. Because I feel very strongly as a Christian, especially then if I have a black brother Christian, yo, I want to tell him some things, you know, as my Christian brother, what we should and shouldn't do. But I've had to sacrifice any talk about what black people should or shouldn't do. So that's skulk. So now with a bit of tension, why did you ask that? And I want to hear if you have a, what's your different opinion, or why is that important for you? So, sorry, I just want to clarify. I'm not saying what I felt is what you're feeling. I'm just sharing mine, and now you can share yours.
Well, what you said makes sense. And as I said, I'm with you. I think I should give.
Yes.
I just sometimes hear that from black guys who are much richer than I am. And, you know, I agree with them. Yes, I should give. But it's hypocritical, right? Because I don't think it's a race thing. And it's not going to stop my giving, and it's not going to stop my feeling of responsibility. But I do observe an irony there.
I observe the irony daily. And that irony is sometimes when people's kids don't have school shoes, they hit Johnny Walker Blue Label. And then if it's my black friends that I'm close with, I let rip. But if it's someone I don't know, I just like, it's your time now, brother, enjoy. So sometimes it's a tricky one. What I want to encourage you, because you look like a great Christian and I know you're with me, I think this call of what Jesus calls us towards, the radical Christianity, is just a human thing, but in the context and the history of our country, it's not just a human thing. So in that sense, I think we must sacrifice that question and let black people get to that conclusion themselves. And it's painful because it doesn't feel right, ne? But I think it's okay not to feel right. For this, like with your kid, I'm not now saying white, black people are kids, a different metaphor. With your kids, sometimes you must allow your kid to get to something by themselves. You can tell them quickly the shortcut, but you leave them, and that's part of love and development and growth. So I think often white people can, there's certain things and topics where, even if it's sincere and it bugs us, where we just have to sacrifice that feeling and let it play out. When I'm very good friends with a black guy, I'll have that chat. But after 20 braais, that's my rule. So you're right, it's wrong, but it's not our time to talk about it. That would be my position. But you're 100% right on that feeling, yes.
Hello.
Hello.
After 1994, Afrikaners were forced to be involved in cultural...
Sorry, who was forced?
Afrikaners were forced to be involved in cultural syncretism, therefore mixing. And we had to reforge our identity. Especially for youth like myself, who grew up primary school after 1994 with black friends into university and continuing today. And it's although it's more focused on the black middle class, not so much the black poorer classes. So, don't you think perhaps the problem is perhaps middle class and lower class? We perhaps have a class problem rather than a cultural problem.
Because do you mean the interaction that was a result of legislation like opening schools, etc., and workplace, is black middle class and white middle class mixing?
Yes.
But that you're saying
I've
black lower class is still out of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I've also found that in my interaction that there's a gap between black middle class and low class. So even they don't get along.
Yes. So what is your question or idea?
Don't you think that this Afrikaans problem is also a class problem? Because we're very much imperialistic in our way of thinking. That is English of class system.
Thank you. Our problem being classes, do you just mean that within Afrikaners class, or do you mean our gap is between rich Afrikaners and poor blacks? That's really the issue, not just white and black.
Mostly the middle class Afrikaner people and low class black people.
Are not mixing.
No.
Yeah, but that's your point. Is that what you're saying? Is that's the big problem, eh?
That is problem, but don't you think that's a stronger problem rather than a racial or a cultural problem?
Yes, I do think so. Because money talks. If you go to Rosebank or the business world, wherever there's enough money, black people and white people get along very well. Afrikaners speak English to make money, but at the church they don't want to make toll. So when on a certain level of fancy shirts and cars and whiskey, people get along very well. And there is obvious the gap. On Mandela Day, when I take people to the township, rich black people create more confusion than the Afrikaners when they eat the shacks. Because they feel they feel entitled, like, hey, I'll tell you, Baba, how I got out. So this is what, you go to school. Ne? So everything I try and teach Afrikaners not to do, when the black ladies pull up in the BMW 740, they do all those things Afrikaners normally do stupid. Because they're so rich and they haven't been sensitized for that cultural gap. So I'm giving my perspective of what I see out there. So I think you're 100% right. The money gap is massive. In fact, when in our work we started a thing to make a bridge between white and black poor and whites, it was changed by the poor kids saying we want white friends and rich black friends. No, because there's a gap. So this thing, zebra crossing, we're trying to do, the two groups we created was township and suburb, not white and black. A massive problem, but in general, 90% of South African whites, what we call middle class, we can say is actually rich because you've got hot water and a car, and 50% of our country is poor, and that is 99% black. So technically, yes, it's a class thing, but really, black people and white people in South Africa are not mixing. White Afrikaners do not have black friends living in shacks. And when I'm asking 40,000 black kids living in shacks, Do you want a white friend? They're like, yeah, if they won't be rude to me, I really would like Afrikaans friend. But where will I find one? So the attitude I get from the shacks is very positive and welcoming, but that double whammy of whiteness and class, it's a very big problem. But yeah, I think the journey of black rich people and their poor, again, like that answer, they're going to have to do that at their own time. Meh? Because now if you encourage the rich black people to reach out, you're like, no, you're not wanting us to enjoy. You enjoy it now, you don't want us to enjoy. Tulani's laughing because he knows these things, ne? It's our time. So there we must just discipline ourselves as Afrikaners and not give advice for rich black people what they should do with their poor. They'll get to that themselves. We have our next step. And I don't mean that arrogant or dismissive. I mean that with a lot of passionate intent for us to make our next step, because sometimes these discussions stop us from taking our next step. I don't care what Motsepe and Cyril does with the kids in the shack. I'm Skalk. I've got my calling. So it's good to reflect on it, but it's not helpful for our next step. But don't make rich black friends. Make all kinds of black friends. Yes, please.
You said to save my ancestors.
Okay. I think most of us can associate or sympathize with that question, am I right? At least all the young people. One thing I've learned from my black friends is when I walk and I bump my foot and I spill my drink on the floor, they'll say, I'm sorry. Ne? Then you're like, no, don't worry, Busi, it's not you. Ne? You know, you've seen this happen a million times. So the way we say sorry can be very nuanced. It can mean I'm sorry for what happened to you. Like when, I nearly used a bad example. Let's say someone gets divorced. Then you'll say, yes, aksiamer, ne? I'm sorry. That doesn't mean I caused them to divorce. Ne? But it's an attitude of sympathy. So that's the first thing where I want to say on a superficial level. The sorry that I want us to say is a sympathetic getting closer to someone else and say, yes, that was no bad. I'm really sorry this happened. No, it's just a compassionate, I don't laugh at your misery. I really feel and see how bad this must be. So that is the first half of the sorry. It's just to say, gee, sorry that happened. Like if the Bulls lose 62-10, I'll say sorry, ne? So there's a big sorry that we can say without assuming guilt for something we did. Ne? That's the first thing I want to say. Is you can be very sympathetic without assuming responsibility for harm. And it is an important distinction, because you should say sorry differently when you stole something and when you didn't. Am I right? But if someone stole something and you're using those stolen goods, I'm glad you're here, Tulani. So if someone stole a truck full of Rolex watches and I then legitimately buy a Rolex watch at half price that was stolen, with that Rolex watch on my... And now I find out the original shop has been hijacked, it's a different story now, because I'm implicit in the process. Still, I won't apologize like the one who hijacked the truck, because I didn't hijack the truck, I bought my watch. But there's a bit now trickiness, because the watch have got baggage. Ne? So it now makes the story a bit different. So what I encourage young people, younger than me, to do, firstly, you say sorry just out of human sympathy, or Christ-like sympathy. But now where Skalk is going to annoy you, the way we live daily in South Africa as white Christians is sinful, because we're selfish. So if you can't apologize for apartheid, you can apologize now for enjoying the benefits of apartheid and not sharing your stuff. If you're not, you must say sorry. So that's again, I'm not giving an answer to South Africa. I'm saying this was my journey. I know myself, I've 100 times said, I didn't do apartheid, I won't apologize. Me, Skalk, I've said that. In my journey, I had to change that position and take a position now where I must deal with a lot of uncertainty because I'm a good ethical guy. But it's a blind spot how the system I'm enjoying is a stolen Rolex. And I hate that because I'm being treated like a criminal and I'm not. But it's tricky. Very, very tricky.
Guys, I know there's a bunch of questions, but we are 15 minutes over time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to allow you guys to speak to Skalky. He doesn't have to work tomorrow or the day after. So or ever for that matter. Because he's sorry. If you want, you can make yourself a cup of coffee over there and then ask Skalk every question that you want. I don't want to ask a question. I just want to thank Skalk. I know it's been very provocative, and I know there's a lot of food for thought.
Can I quickly interrupt?
Yes, you can.
Sorry, for tonight to have integrity and me not looking like a funny guy from Joburg coming in, causing confusion and running away, a commitment that I'm very serious about is if anyone wants to have a chat with me or argue with me or whatever, he's got my email address. I'll literally be very happy with you or two of you or three of you to sit and come over. I'll drive across the Boerewors-Gordijn again. And I'll happily have a coffee or a meal with anyone to clarify on some of the things which I say, because I know some of the links I've made through a long time seems odd to other people. So to keep the evening real, I really want to give an invitation to chat rustig one-on-one with anyone. I'll be very happy to do that. So just email me, and I'll spend that time to clarify or to apologize.
Yeah. Let's give him a round of applause. He's done well. Thank you. I'm going to give him this chocolate that I bought 5 minutes before it started, and I realized I need to give him a gift. And after his talk, I know he's going to give it back to me after I've given it to him. And then in the end...
I prefer Top Deck or Oreos. So.
Yeah, those are more politically correct chocolates, yeah. You're right. But Skalk, thank you so much. And guys, if you're feeling frustrated or if you're sitting here with a massive paradox, that's okay. You don't have to agree with everything Skalk said. We had Tien Sielhoff here a while ago, and he definitely didn't say everything that Skalk said. And that's also okay. You don't have to agree with Tien, or you don't have to agree with me, or anybody else here. But the thing that we really want to stress is to be a little bit uncomfortable and to think about these things authentically. And it's going to be tough. But ultimately, we as a community, we want to figure these things out whilst we make mistakes and whilst we're going forward. And please, one of the ways that you can really help and where you can really make a good black friend is to be involved with the Tembisa project. So if you're interested in this was a wonderful pitch. So we got him to talk an hour and a half. Just to actually tell you, be involved with the Tembisa stuff, and speak to. You. So that was basically that. But Skalk, thank you so much for sharing from your experience and teaching us a little bit about sacrifice. And I think that is the word that stood out. And I really want to urge you. Let's look at applications and do not accept everything. That's an open invitation. He'll buy the coffee. He'll come through, and you can have that conversation. All right. So with that said, next week, same place, same time, different speaker. Travel safe. Remember all of those other things. The pass, Etta. If there's any questions about anything, please come and talk to me. Okay.